your life support services are dependent on something like Ember or a stock market, you know that you failed because complex systems are inherently unpredictable and prone to collapse. So you have to basically say, how do we make sure that our life support services are not generated by complex systems? And that approach of, I mean, this is your Kinevan stuff, right?
When you Snowden's Kinevan stuff.
Well, Snowden's Kinevan stuff, but your Kinevan Plus stuff. But when you recognize that your life support is coming from the complex domain, you now have a red flag emergency. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of, you know, I mean, this is something that we've worked on, but there's a lot of reasons for believing that complex systems are inherently fallible. And if you die if the system fails, you shouldn't be depending on it.
But we also talked about actually the catastrophe is probably unstoppable just because of the nature of human beings. We won't take any notice of it and do what we should do until the catastrophes happen.
One of the topics that came up in our conversation, which kind of relates to both of those points, was whether or not human cognitive and social capacities are advanced enough to actually deal with these multiple relationship, multiple timeline situations. I'm on the side that they're usually not, although you don't have to actually take a stance on that to see how these transitions occur. But there's a certain level of, I guess, humility, really, that comes into this notion. It's like, how are you going to ever get a job as a professor or a CEO saying, like, you know, I don't really know that much.
Yeah.
I don't really know what's going on. I'm just doing my best.
It's worked for Nick Clegg this
week.
Not yet.
I just said this week.
Nick Clegg would never get asked a question like how he would manage a certain crisis. Tonight they're going to be asked questions about what policies, what decisions they make. No one's asking them for the questions that I'm interested in, which is how will you manage this country for the next five year period?
That's pretty important.
And that's kind of like what you were saying, approach two problems, not assumption four problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyone else?
You talked about dynamism.
Solve it and then we stop. Whereas it's about engagement with a continuum. And that's a completely different set of techniques because, as Mary was saying, you respect the history and you realize that all you're doing is influencing and adjusting. And who is the best person? Who is the person in the best position to do that influencing and adjusting? It's probably not the donor, it's probably not the aid agency, it's probably not even the field workers. So who is that? How do you work that?
That kind of relates to something we were talking about. We talk about adjusting, in terms of the continuum. Where are the feedback loops? Because in a lot of cases, we'll say aid implementers are self-evaluating to their own source of funding. It's going to sort of color slightly how self-critical you are in terms of where you're helping a situation. That to me is kind of one of the fundamental, what's it called, the issues within the aid system. The feedback loops aren't maybe as effective as they need to be to take on board this complex or complex adaptive type of environment.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of talked, I guess, around some sort of issues of the limits range of common. Thank you. understand that. So if you're talking about paradigm shift, different paradigms, I think there are significant limits on understanding.
There's another mindset thing, which is that we see crises, what we interpret as crises, as malformed. If we damped everything down, the world would stop. So there is a sense in which actually we need to accept that in the dynamics of the natural system, these perturbations are part of what generates the variety and the novelty and the richness and the life. It's like the stock market. You damp down the whole banks of the stock market, so all the degrees of freedom are locked. It's just going to break. And that's, I think, probably one of the dilemmas for aid. That maybe if you get a society nice and calm, you may actually destroy the very thing that makes that a vibrant society.
Yeah, that's such a difficult issue, because I was really intrigued with your example of this decentralization of prioritization of the religious, but then at a certain point, you know, what if that goes towards funding boys' education and not girls, or you know,
mm-hmm.
these types of things, which we quote unquote someone finds morally objectionable. And it's, you're dealing with things which are so touchy. And
can I give
you
an example?
It's a challenge. You know?
Switzerland pushes power so far down to the edges that your population has to vote to see whether you can become a Swiss citizen, and it turns out that it's almost impossible to become a Swiss citizen for black. That's an example of a decentralization pathology, and it's really, really a big deal in Switzerland.
Right, and it's an inability, I think, perhaps it's not an issue, a social issue, or
it's,
we all operate as like local actors with local variables.
It's the
same
thing
with managed emerging externalities. Like,
every few years, somebody comes up with the idea when you walk through the refugee camps and hand out cash. Like Haiti, we've raised just the charitable donations are $600 for every affected person. Well, if you just release those funds in US dollars right now, you'd get a boom in Haiti, which would actually solve a lot of their immediate problems. But you'd also get a whole bunch of pathological behavior too. So it's kind of, you know, that's the extreme limit is just set up
right now.
Also, like, your point, I think, is really a good one. This is just adding to the natural generations in systems. And that's really important when you approach it. You know, a global system that's heading towards 9 billion people and is heading within the next 30, 40 years to be 75% or more urbanized.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got high concentrations of large numbers of people, and the average person will just not accept that these are natural perturbations, that we can't do something about it, that we should understand these systems and we should fix them. Somebody is responsible and somebody should fix them. And know, the politics, all of those sorts of issues come into play. So complexity is there. Complexity is a real live problem that is going to become more and more exponentially important for all of us. I don't see that there are naturally any insights or solutions that are going to be commonly built.
Mm. So that leads us quite nicely onto a point that you've made to me in the break. I don't know if you want to just...
Because although I think I agree that complexity theory doesn't provide specific what's, because they are always context dependent, but nevertheless, there are certain situations where we can say this is far more likely to work in this context than that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are getting to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it is not just an abstract thing. It can be very, very practical, and therefore I think the what is beginning to develop. But it's not the same what in every context. That's the whole point. The other thing I think complexity does very well is to explain why. Why do these social phenomena happen? If we understand that, we can then address them. We can use the different principles of complexity to say, this is how we create the environment to address this ongoing problem. because there is never going to be a single solution. But if we can create a sustainable enabling environment that co-evolves with a changing environment, we stand a chance. But all that has to come together, and that understanding has to come together. So the what, the how, and underpinned by the why, I think complexity can offer. But you do need a deeper understanding than a superficial one of what it means to use complexity principles and how you can actually use them.
I think there's a general theme here that if you're dealing with complex systems, you know they're not going to behave nicely. And
they're not going to behave nicely. Oh, no. Right.
So I think that there's a real, there's a simple approach here, which is when you see complex systems that are being pressured in vital ways, try and move back into the domain of the simple. Right? I mean, if we had a general recipe that when you understand that you're dealing with a complex system, it's a red flag for an operation. And you try and push the vital systems back into the simple domain, I think there's actually a lot of room for a practice where we recognise complexity as a problem. Okay, we've got 34 aid agencies that are attempting to do 3 tasks in this area. This is going to be a disaster. We all know that from the field. So looking at situations that have complex systems properties as inherently problematic and then running away from them, I think is a very rational approach.
Alex, and then I'm going to carry on.
On the decentralization example that I tossed out there, were two things that I was able to identify that made those processes at that level work best. The first was, and both of them are within the control of a large-scale development organization or funder. The first was allowing or facilitating hyperconnectivity within communities. Essentially, what you're doing is trying to create a self-organizational group by increasing the connections between it. It's just nodes and connections back to that. And so what that does is it creates a self-regulation within it where checks and balances are put into place by the people within it and increased transparency. The second thing is defining what I would call the semi-permeable memory that these activities must take place within. And that is saying, we will allow you to make decisions about this aid that is coming from outside of your community, but it must conform to the following 3 to 5 things, which would deal with everyone, the beneficiaries must be equitable across society, so not just male schools versus female schools. And you define the few criteria within which they will self-organize, and then let them at it. And it goes back to a link to Sandra here when she was talking about work that she's doing on confederation-style organization theory. The confederation says this much we all agree on, and you must agree on to be part of this confederation. Within that, you define it yourself, and that's where you get into examples of biology and all this other kind of stuff. Sort of where that works. I have seen work on the governance and development side of things in that context.
That's a good clarification. Thanks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Really, really useful pointers there. I'm going to carry on now and say a little bit about what these ideas have meant or are meaning for those working in aid agencies. And I gave you a slide a little bit earlier on about the numbers of people that have been doing work on complexity in social, political, economic realms generally. In aid and development, the ideas have been utilised at a relatively slow pace. So there was work in the 1990s done by a few people. The early noughties, again, slowly growing. And I think there's been much more work in the last 3 to 5 years. Sean will probably help me here in confirming whether or not he sees it that way as well. But I think there's been much more work done in the last 3 to 5 years on these issues. More systematic work, more people trying to explore these issues, more people identifying particular areas like conflict prevention or water management and saying, what does complexity mean in this setting? And there seems to be a bit of a flowering of these things. But I've tried to, on a blog which I run on this topic, I've tried to compile a library, an evolving library of publications. So a lot of these you can find either the link to the Amazon page where you can purchase it or the online link to the document itself. So do access that if you're interested. I myself did make a small contribution to this area in 2008 in an ODI working paper, the primary aim of which was to explore the potential value of complexity science for those who work specifically on change and reform issues within the aid sector, which is what I was primarily working on in that time. So he looked at a lot of the scientific and experimental literature, work from physiology, physics, maths, public sector reform, sociology, economics, organisation theory, plus case studies, reports and evaluations from within the sector. Reviewed over 250 articles, books and reports and evaluations for that, conducted it, and had 10 peer reviewers, including Sean, who's in the audience today. Just a little word to the wise, never actually send something out to 10 peer reviewers if they're all likely to respond. They all responded, which made my life hell for about 4 months. It was published in 2008, and that's also available to download, and I've given you copies. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about now is really what, if anything, complexity science implies for development of humanitarian work. And I'm going to talk to the ideas which are presented in the paper, but also some more of the evolving thinking that I've done since the paper, which I'll explain a little bit more later on. So there are three areas which relate to, and you'll be familiar with these three questions, because they're the three aspects of systems which the linear framework tells us something about. They're the three aspects of systems which complexity challenges, I think. And I think these three questions are fundamental to understanding the implications, if any, for development in humanitarian work. So I'm going to talk through each of these. There's much more to say about each of these areas than I've got time for it. But I'm going to pick up just a couple of concepts within each of these. So first, the nature of systems. Move on to the nature of change, and then the nature of actors. So the nature of systems, the most immediate and obvious thing is that complex systems have interconnected and interdependent elements and dimensions. They're interconnected to different ways, to different degrees. This interconnectedness can take place between any element, between any dimension, between systems and between environments. And this interconnectedness leads to an interdependence between the elements and the dimensions of the system. And it's this interdependence that gives rise to complex and chaotic behaviour in systems. Now, researchers identified that you can characterise complex systems as tightly or loosely coupled, both internally and with their environment. And that gives rise to different kinds of complex behaviours. So the classic tightly coupled system is global foreign exchange markets. And people describe that using the metaphor when America sneezes, China catches a cold very quickly. The classic loosely coupled system, university systems or global construction industry, where the fitness of those industries are reliant on them not being too tightly interdependent. So there are some connectivity within particular projects, within particular institutions, but the system as a whole is much more loosely coupled. If one university goes down, it's unlikely to bring the whole university system tumbling to the ground. And if you, starting with this particular idea, you can actually use various mapping techniques and analysis to try and understand, at least better understand, the dynamics and the interactions that go on within a particular system. But before you do this, there's a couple of principles that you need to take on board. First of all, complexity is nested, and this is just one example which takes us from atoms through to communities. And I think this is a particularly important one because in the aid sector, there's a sense that people view the global setting as very complex, but then when you get down to the local setting, somehow everything gets very simple and straightforward, and your linear intervention will work okay. Actually, there's a self-similarity. There is equal complexity at the local level, at the smallest level of interaction, as there is at the highest level. And that nesting is a really important aspect of complex systems to understand. And the issue here is that the interconnectedness of real-world systems is often not recognised or acknowledged. And there are three ways, and these three kind of areas are archetypes, if you like, and they're used in different ways. They underlie the Kinefin framework. I think Kinefin also uses chaotic. Ralph Stacey's work on complex system uses a variant of these. So different people use different variants of these. But these three kind of kinds of puzzles, or three approaches to problems, if you like. So the simple is the following a recipe model. So the recipe is essential. Recipes are tested to assure the replicability of efforts. You don't need any particular expertise, whereas obviously knowing how to cook increases your chance of success. The recipe will note the quantity and nature of the parts needed, and you'll produce, hopefully, reasonably standard products. And there is reasonable certainty of the same results every time. I can see those who might not feel that comfortable in the kitchen grinning here, slightly writhing. But there's a certain way in which you can follow a recipe in order to solve a puzzle and be reasonably sure of success every time. Complicated problems. Let's say sending a rocket to the moon. So formulae are critical and are necessary. Sending one rocket to the moon increases the assurance that the next will also be successful. There is a high level of expertise in many different fields. What is absolutely essential is coordination between these different problems. But actually, it is about separating things into different parts and coordinating. There is still a reductionist approach that you can take to solve these particular issues. Rockets are similar in critical ways, and there is a high degree of certainty about them. The third area, the classic example that's given, is raising a child. So formula have only a limited applicability. Solving one problem, if that's how you want to see your child, gives no assurance of success with the next. Expertise can help, but is not sufficient. Relationships are key. You can't separate the parts from the whole unless you want to call social services in. Every problem or child is unique, and uncertainty of outcome remains often long after the point where it should. So these different ways, and these are archetypes, this underlies how lots of people try and look at different systems and system problems. And Russ Ackoff, this is a very noted 1970s systems thinker, said some of the greatest mistakes are made when you're dealing with a mess. You don't see all of its dimensions in their entirety. You carve off a part, you deal with this part as if it was a problem, and then solve it as if it was a puzzle, all the while ignoring the linkages and connections to the other dimensions of the mess.
Ben, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Just to start coming a little bit, if complexity is nested in fractals, if you're able to solve one of the fractals, would that apply to the entire system?
So it's not necessarily the same kind of complexity all the way through. It's just that there is complexity all the way through. So what you're saying is that there's a sense in which a solution at one level should be applicable at all levels of the system. And I don't think that is the case. There is complexity. But what you do in order to understand atoms is not the same thing you do in order to understand societies, for example.
I think there are a few areas of stability in that matter. Like network theory is pretty generally applicable.
Mm.
But I do think it's very patchy.
Yeah. So the extent of interconnectedness and interdependence, what I call messiness here, what others have called wicked problems or wickedness, usually becomes visible during crises, i.e. when it's too late. And we can think of a number of examples, September the 11th, which identified the interconnectedness between globalization and terrorism, the credit crunch, the interconnectedness between mortgage mis-selling and the world economy, food price rises, which are really about biofuel speculation and the impact on food prices. Climate change, Western consumerism, southern disasters, we're slowly starting to see the effects there. Dare I say it, volcanic ash and airlines. Underlying all of these crises is a lack of attention to different perspectives and their interconnectedness. What usually happens is that there will be a few people that say this is a problem, this is likely to happen, individuals. But institutionally, we seem to be very bad at picking up on these signals. That for all of these different things, there have been people long before the disaster actually happened saying there is an interconnectedness here that we're not witnessing. But no one had the incentives to actually deal with it. Now, I would argue that that kind of issue, that kind of blindness, has particular unique manifestations in the aid sector. And the reason is that there is a broken feedback loop between the recipients of aid and those that plan and design it. And that broken feedback loop means that there are very few incentives, if any, for aid agencies to adapt to the circumstances that they're actually normally trying to solve. So aid effectiveness, aid reform, all of these different issues are couched in the fact that there's no real feedback that happens. That feedback isn't there. Sometimes it's actually beneficial for the aid agency because they can carry on raising and spending money without actually addressing the underlying problem. What that means is that real world, complex and messy nature of systems is frequently not recognised. Simple solutions can be repeatedly applied to complex problems. And the people that run aid programmes can basically say, well, these theories, these ideas, they're not very practical. But they themselves, as Keynes famously said, are slaves to a number of defunct economists. There are certain principles that underlie the way aid work happens at the moment. So what are the implications? Well, for my mind, I think there's a number. First of all, you need to analyse and deal with the complex realities and dynamics of the aid system itself, understanding how aid problems are interconnected and interdependent. Now, at the moment, there's a convenient shorthand that dominates. there's a disaster, there's a lack of food, therefore let's get food out there. There's a country that's got flawed education, let's support their education policies. And complexity and mistakes are glossed over in light of this kind of convenient shorthand. Now I'd say, at a minimum, what we need to do is say the rational planning model, the linear model, is useful in some limited settings, but other tools could also be of use. And we need to try and deal with messes, problems, and puzzles using at least tools that are relevant, approaches that are relevant to the kinds of issues we're dealing with. And ultimately, I think what this means is the role of aid agency as the grand designer should be avoided in favour of facilitation, orchestration, and creating the enabling environments for emergent change. The way that aid agencies are currently set up, their structures, they're like Ford, sending out their aid. Ford in the 1920s, there's some kind of production line sending out aid in very reasonably standardised ways to different countries. I think we need to be thinking about aid agencies as eBay. What does aid agency as a broker of aid look like? What is it?
Yeah. There is one.
Yeah.
It's called ACVRO, A-K-V-R-O. And it's literally an eBay for small water projects, including the reputation management stuff that closes the feedback loops.
Yeah.
Villagers
oh,
and
fantastic.
Phone cameras reporting on their wells.
Well, I'll need to pick up on that.
I'll tell you
what.
Yes.
What was the name again? ACVRO, A-K-V-R-O.org. Funded by the Dutch government, mainly. Very nice shops in London office if anybody wants to.
There are more features of systems which we can talk about, particularly emergence and feedback loops, but I'm not going to go into detail here on those. I'm going to move on to talk about the nature of change. What is complexity science implied to development of humanitarian work? This is my big bugbear, by the way. This is the thing that gets me most riled. Because most aid planning frameworks model change as linear based on a cause and effect relationship. X is aid, leads to Y. It leads to Y in a linear and predictable way. You focus on the end result, and the program, whatever Y is, X gets the credit for it. And there are a number of commonly held assumptions which are based on linear thinking, and I'm going to go into these to some detail just so I can, I guess, whack them afterwards. Number one, there's the idea that change can be focused on specific areas, holding all other things constant. It's the idea that changes are proportional to the input, and the idea that changes are additive. Now, we know that in interconnected, interdependent systems, small events can trigger huge effects, and huge efforts may have negligible effects. So let's talk about each of these assumptions in turn. So the assumption of linearity, the first one, holding all other things constant, is what's known as the independent variable, that you can isolate one particular thing and work on that. The ideas and propositions are tested by making comparisons which are identical apart from that one variable. So, for example, we want to improve education policy in country X, we want to improve health policy in country Y, we know that education policy was improved in country X doing A, B, and C, let's do A, B, and C in the other country. Now, that just simply does not work if you take any two countries, and there are lots of examples of it. One example which is really prominent is the Ugandan AIDS miracle. In 1990, Uganda was facing potentially the worst HIV epidemic rates of any country in sub-Saharan Africa. By 2000, they turned that around through a process which they called a social vaccine, a process of abstaining, being faithful, and using condoms. And that actually saw the levels of HIV drop dramatically in a way that never happened anywhere else. The US government picked up on this and said, right, so everyone around the world needs to abstain, be faithful, and use condoms. And they ploughed a huge amount of money into trying to make this work in lots of other places. It failed dismally. But it was just one example of how the local minimum rules, which actually enabled something remarkable to happen, weren't then applicable elsewhere. And the reason is that in complex systems of interconnected and interrelated parts, holding all other things constant is almost impossible. Everything else cannot be held constant. There is no independent variable. It's impossible to just look at one thing or just make it one change. The next thing is changes in output being proportional to changes in input. Well, one of the things that all of the parties in the UK currently agree on is that they will commit legally to 0.7% of GDP being provided in the form of aid. That is an input-related measure of aid. let's be clear, it's about what Western governments will be willing to pay. It's meaningless, actually, in terms of what it means. We should have measures or standards which relate to what aid will be achieving. More aid does not lead to more poverty reduction. More aid does not lead to more growth. The absorption capacity in developing countries needs to be taken into account. More aid doesn't necessarily relate to better aid. In complex systems, the output is not proportional to the input. The relationship is highly non-linear. And even a small amount of money can do a great deal of work in some settings. In other settings, a huge amount of money does absolutely nothing. And the third area is about what's called additivity. The idea that if you do A and it leads to X, and you do B and it leads to Y, then A plus B in any given setting would lead to X plus Y. So you can think of any number of settings where this would actually apply. This, again, does not hold in complex systems. The consequences of any action depends on the presence or absence of many other factors. And they may well interact with each other, and the order in which action is taken may affect outcomes. But again, this linearity, this assumption of additionality does apply quite significantly to the it's quite a serious kind of assumption with a lot of aid work. And perhaps the most interesting articulation of this is in the Millennium Development Goals. And this is the Millennium Development Goal of Universal Primary Education by 2015. So there's the idea that you'll have inputs, which will be financial and physical resources, spending on primary education, which will lead to outputs, goods and services, which generate the number of schools that are built, the textbooks that provide the teachers that are trained, which will lead to outcomes, access to use of and satisfaction with services such as enrollment, repetition, dropout rates, share of schools with active parents organisations, and that ultimately will affect on dimensions of well-being around literacy, and that will achieve universal primary education by 2015. Classic articulation of the linear framework. The reality